Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Frances Sachs, and today I'm joined by writer Ray Naylor to talk about his new book, The Mountain in the Sea. Set in the near future, the book chronicles the stories of otherwise unrelated characters as their lives are touched in various ways by the same conglomerate AI company, DeAnima. Upon coming into contact with DeAnima, either willingly or unwillingly, the characters must reckon with forms of intelligence different than that of humans. Throughout the stories, the boundaries of what counts as consciousness somehow contract and broaden at the same time. Consciousness becomes something mappable and replicable, but also extends beyond the exclusive purview of Homo sapiens. Ray, welcome to the show.
Frances, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I thought we could start by talking about what inspired you to write this book.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good complicated question right off the bat, actually. It's hard sometimes to say what inspires a novel. I'm usually a short story writer, so usually what inspires a short story is you get like one idea. It's usually a pretty clear idea, and then it mixes with a few other things and you get a short story out of it. For a novel, I think it's like everything in your life on one hand, and then it's like a few specific incidents on the other hand. So I worked on Condal on some projects with youth, helping them to photograph small species like insects and frogs, lizards, that kind of thing, for a group called Biodiversity Peak, the biodiversity group. And then they have a program called Biodiversity Peak. And we worked on a program called Biodiversity Peak Condal. And the idea was to empower these youth who are living in this nature preserve and marine protected area to be involved in looking at life there and documenting it. And they would upload these pictures to a website where US scientists would then identify the species. And the youth could sort of see how they had contributed to the scientific process. It was really interesting, and especially because we had this big ambition to have them also learn how to scuba dive so they could go out and photograph the reefs and the, you know, all of the life out there. But we found out that they couldn't swim. Even though they had grown up on these islands, they really were very alienated from the world around them. And I mean, I think that's, it was interesting because it's sort of symptomatic of the way that modern life is. Like, we're so alienated from nature, but this was like just very in your face. It was like, wow, they live on a place that is, you know, so completely involved with the ocean, but they can't swim in it. And so we taught them how to swim and then how to snorkel and scuba dive. And I think, you know, overall the program was great because it just gave them a sense of being more integrated into the place where they were. In the place where they grew up. So that was a big inspiration, that work. Also just my fascination with the octopus and with animal intelligence in general. It's something that I've been really interested in for a long time. I'm interested in biosemiotics, which is a kind of, seems like a very esoteric title, but it's a pretty basic idea. It's the idea that life fundamentally exists of the exchange of information. So that there's a strata, of course, that life exists in, a physical, you know, form that we all have, but that physical form is formed out of informational exchanges at the cellular level, and then all the way up through the cultural level of exchange. And that basically each one of us is this constant process of exchanging information, both internally within our own systems and then externally with other agents, other people, parts of the environment, animals, etc. So that kind of fascination, that sort of concrete experience combines with my fascination with misunderstanding. So I've spent 20 years living outside of the United States and very much outside of my own context that I grew up in. I grew up in California, and I pretty solidly grew up in one place. I mean, a lot of Americans move around, but I actually spent my entire education in California from kindergarten all the way through graduating from university. So I was very embedded in this one place. And then I moved to Turkmenistan to be a Peace Corps volunteer. And I learned what it was to be completely out of context and misunderstood and to be ignorant again of, you know, how you communicate with a human being, right? The Turkmen were very different from Americans, of course, and had their very particular points of view on the world. They were also quite isolated. So it was one of these societies where there was real difference. They did not participate much in the global monoculture, and they really had like a very, very strikingly unique way of looking at a lot of things. So those kinds of ideas of miscommunication, of animal communications and life fundamentally existing, you know, as a communicative practice. And then that place, the Kanda Archipelago, which is just so beautiful. And those things all sort of somehow came together and inspired me to start writing this. And maybe the spark was just my daughter being born, because I realized that I started really seriously writing the novel about a month after she was born. And I give this as my worst piece of writing advice ever, which is you should always start writing your novel 1 month after the birth of a child. Like the absolute worst time to try to do anything. That's kind of a lengthy answer, but at the same time, I mean, I don't know how to shorten it, because a novel is just always this dense thing that comes out of so many different places.
Could you give a brief overview of the main storylines of the book, just to orient people while we're talking and referencing characters?
Sure. There's three main storylines in the book. The central one, what I would say the main protagonist is Dr. Han Nguyen, and she is invited by D'Anima, this big AI corporation, to come to the Kanda Archipelago, which has been evacuated or, you know, cleared of its residents and cordoned off from the rest of the world. She's invited there to try to establish communication with what the corporation believes is a symbol-using octopus. And I'm very careful about these terms because most animals are probably sentient, meaning they have a sense of self of some kind or another, and an increasing sense of self as they become more complex and their nervous systems grow. So theoretically, right, an insect would have a low sense of self, but there might be some kind of presence there, something that it means to be an insect. And then if you get up to, say, a dolphin probably has a very concrete sense of being an individual in the world. So she's there to try to establish some kind of communications with this species and study it. In the second line in the novel, there is a character called Rustem, who has been hired by an unknown entity to break into a very complex AI system. And this is what Rustem does for a living. But that becomes increasingly dangerous as he sort of learns more about what he's really been tasked to do. And then in the third line, we have Eiko, who is a slave on a fishing vessel, which is captained by an AI captain. And this third narrative line follows really closely the reality of today, which is that we have tens of thousands of slaves on fishing vessels all over the world. We don't call people slaves anymore. We like to call them, trafficked persons, or come up with other euphemisms, right? But the fact is that slavery is a really widespread part of the modern world. And there may be, in fact, more slaves right now than there ever were in human history, given the large numbers of people that there are. And I would define a slave as anyone who's forced to work for no compensation by another entity and has their freedom taken away from them in some way. So that's something that's happening to millions and millions, tens of millions, let's say. I don't think anyone really has good numbers on it today. So that third line is the closest in some ways to a reality, except for the AI captain and the fully autonomous fishing vessel. Otherwise, it's pretty close. So those three narrative lines seem very, very separate, but I promise readers they do converge toward the end of the book. I think that's, what do you think? Is that a good enough description to get people started?
Perfect. I would be hooked. So the first thing I was struck by when I just opened the book, among the first pages, was just how vivid the imagery of places in your writing, particularly when it's dominated by water. And I feel like every time you introduce a new character, it's within the context of some kind of water. I just wanted to read one of the first lines that you write in the book, it stuck with me so much, which was, "The plastic awning of the cafe streamed with rain. Under its shelter, wreathed in kitchen steam and human chatter, waiters wove between tables with streaming bowls of soup, glasses of iced coffee, and bottles of beer. Beyond the walls of rain, electric motorbikes swept past like luminescent fish." Why does water play such a big role in the backdrop of this book, and also the forefront of this book?
It's really interesting. I had never actually thought about it, but you're right. The four books of The Mountain and the Sea all have to do with water and take place sort of on or near or, in the water in some way. Yeah, that's kind of a revelation for me. I actually had not thought about that. So it must be something that's operating kind of underneath my very conscious level of structuring the book. But I do think that a big part of the book's idea is that we come from the ocean, right? We really do. And we do carry the ocean, the salinity levels of the ocean, the traces of our evolutionary history and our sort of march out of the sea with us. And I think that for me, water is very closely tied to an idea of connectivity with the world. So one of the amazing things about scuba diving is when you dive, you really feel as if you become a part of the water around you. Because especially if you're diving in a place like Vietnam, where the water is close to your own body temperature and you're not fighting off the difference between the very cold water around you and your blood, you really get the sense of almost entering into the world's bloodstream, right? Like being inside and involved with the world. And I was always, I feel that when I'm around, the ocean, but I also feel it like with rain and things like that. Water sort of forces us into connection with the world in a way that air does not. Air is really interesting because, in Buddhist meditation, one of the things that they'll try to get you to do is to concentrate on the breath. And the reason you need to concentrate on the breath is because air doesn't feel like a medium at all. It's as if there's just nothing there and we're drifting around. We're not connected to the world. We're completely independent. And it gives us this false sense of disconnectedness. I think that water removes that and it really pulls you back into the fact that you are an object in the world, living inside it, with it, and subject to it.
I think it also seems like it served as a connection with the machine. It served to connect us to the machine in your book as well, because when I think of water, I also think of, we come from water and our bodies are, so much of our bodies are water, and it feels like something that's very connected to the living and to nature. And so then maybe put in contrast with the not alive, with machines or electricity. And it kind of just seems like it is falls on our side of the binary with technology. So for you to have machines in the book, like I'm thinking of Evrim, that scene where Evrim is comes out of the water and is like glistening with the drops of water on her body, on their body. I think that it kind of serves to break down the barrier that you're kind of chipping away at the whole book between human and machine.
Yeah, I love that idea. Again, you're demonstrating for me the way in which, like, I think as a writer, I learn a lot from readers who are good at the act of reading. And I've always said this, but sometimes it doesn't feel entirely true, that I'm just one reader in the end of my own work, and that the work is really not complete until it connects with the mind of a reader. But you're doing a good job of demonstrating why that's really true, because that's not something that, again, that I wasn't, there are metaphors that I consciously constructed in the book that I was very, very aware of. And there are other things that kind of extend out from that awareness. And, you know, one of the points maybe of the book, and I think a point in general that I would make about consciousness, is that consciousness exists in this narrow sort of strip between unknowns, the unknown sort of other, which we can't fully communicate with or articulate, everything that's around us and reality as it is rather than as we perceive it. And then underneath that, the unknown self, all of this neural activity, all of this cellular communication, all of the things that are happening in our own body and even in our own minds that we're not really aware of, and that push up into our motivations and make us think and do things that we're not aware of. And I think when you're a writer, some of the writing is occurring in that band, and some of the writing is occurring also just below that band. And I'm often confronted with this idea that, you know, when I reread my own work, that I'm not aware of having written it in some way, that it seems to have come from somewhere else. And I think that somewhere else is just this mysterious kind of underpinning set of layers that aren't quite, you know, there. But certainly the Evrim and their emergence from this medium, which they're even more efficient in than humans are, right? Because Evrim doesn't breathe and therefore doesn't have any trouble being amphibious, right? And being able to be in the water and on land with the same sort of comfort. That for me, yeah, it's a lot of the book is about trying to transcend binary barriers. One of the initial binary barriers was just a challenge I set up for myself, where I was told by someone, you know, well, books can either be really informative or they can be really entertaining. And I was like, I want to try to write a book that's really entertaining and informative. Like, I want to do both. So, you know, because I don't believe in that binary. In fact, I don't believe in binaries at all, for a lot of reasons. But because I think that they're sort of a pernicious construct and a way of categorizing things that leads to all kind of false categorizations. But you know, that's a really good point. There's this moment in the book where Evrim sort of shatters that binary. But I think Evrim as a character in general is a shattering for me of that binary between machine and human.
Totally. It sounds like, what kind of philosophy were you reading when you were writing this book? It sounds kind of like New Materialist, Donna Haraway.
Yeah, I love Donna Haraway. I've read a lot of Donna Haraway. I wasn't reading her in particular when I was writing this book, but I'm a big sponge that absorbs, you know, everything that I've encountered. And Donna Haraway was one of those encounters, especially in my undergraduate years at UC Santa Cruz. I was very into Donna Haraway. A huge influence on me early on was Kaya Silverman, and her book, The Subject of Semiotics, which sort of combines semiotics and psychoanalysis and Lacanian, you know, stuff into this amazing new thing. Also, film theory is in there and the idea of like suture and all these other things. I was reading a lot of biosemiotics, Jesper Hofmeyr, and then Eva Yablonka, who is an evolutionary theorist and also, I think, a philosopher. I mean, I think the great scientists are philosophers, really. And lately, I've been reading a lot of sort of scientist philosophers. And then Terence Deacon is another one. Incomplete Nature was a book that really heavily influenced The Mountain and the Sea. Terence Deacon makes some really sophisticated, complex arguments about how consciousness might have emerged and how life might have emerged that I find convincing. But it's kind of, you know, I engage in this kind of bricolage, right? Like it's just putting together what I find useful, because in the end, what I really believe, and I think this is true of science as well right now, is that we are in the age of metaphor. We are trying to describe the world in more and more sophisticated ways with more and more sophisticated models, but all of those models are metaphoric. And we need to be really careful not to reverse the metaphors. And this is something that happens a lot, I think, in science, right? Is you get, well, we're creating these AI and we are creating this machine learning processes that mimic the human, you know, as far as we can. And we're creating robots that mimic humans' movement through space. Therefore, human beings are computers and robots, right? We're just really sophisticated computers and robots. Well, this is false. It's a dangerous reversal of metaphor, right? We are patterning these things that we're inventing off of the things that we have come to understand about human beings. It's not that human beings suddenly become computational, right? It's that computation and our development of sophisticated ways of computation extends from our basic understanding, very, very basic surface understanding of what is going on in our own minds and our own thinking processes. So we're in this kind of metaphorical state right now. And I do think that, you know, Carlo Rovelli, other sophisticated sort of scientist philosophers fully understand that what science is essentially doing is just trying to find more and more sophisticated descriptive metaphors for the world.
Totally. And speaking of which, I'm going to link all of those names that you just said in the blog post, everybody.
Oh, awesome. Great.
So I just want to go back to that idea of binary for a second. Mm-hmm. In terms of the characters. I thought that one of the ways that you broke down binaries really well in the book was through Alten Tsetseng, mm-hmm. in her cyborgianism, in that mm-hmm. she, first of all, her human body seems like a amalgamation of different experience and technologies that have kind of constructed it and mm-hmm. constructed it and then reconstructed it again. All of her mm-hmm. scar tissue and her muscles and just her physical form is such a response to the technology that she's dealt with and that she's mm-hmm. the violence that's been enacted on her through that technology in her time in the war and as a security.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, I love that.
But I also think that even more obviously, I think it was really cool how you had her hooked up to a translator, and that translator could either be a mechanism for people to understand her better or a mechanism for her to kind of shield herself from an understanding. There's two different translators. There's a kind of a jankier translator that doesn't really work and that she can hide behind when she just wants to kind of be not fully engaging with people. And then there's a translator that works really well that she can fully engage with the people around her. So I think that was one really interesting way that she was a cyborg. And also that she was so even better than communicating with the people around her. She was better at communicating with the machines around her. She has such a flawless communication with that security operation that she runs. And the way you described it as like it was kind of coming right off the tips of her fingers. Mm-hmm. She could operate it almost as if it were limbs, her own limbs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was that, were you thinking about her in kind of a cyborgian way when you were designing that character?
Yeah. So I think that in some ways, Altan Setseg is like my favorite character in the book. I mean, I love all my characters, you know, they're like children and they're all wonderful, but for me, she allows the book to do things that it couldn't do without her. And one of those is really exploring that where the boundaries of the body are, right? Like, where does the body end? She's able to sort of extend her body out into space, into all of these devices that she controls. And she's able to, in some senses, extend her consciousness far beyond the boundaries of her skull, right? Because she can see things that are happening very far away, since she's controlling all of these, somewhat misnamed drones, right? Because they're not fully drones. They're sort of a new technology, but so she's controlling this whole set of both offensive and defensive, you know, weapons around the island, but also this observational platform that no one else has access to. She's able to find people and see things that aren't going on around. So she has this presence that extends outside of her body. And then, as you say, she's, you know, I would point out to people that she's one of the only characters in, besides Evrim, who is physically described in the book. So because the physical description of her is important, because she is marked by technology, right? By war and by her past. And so she has this, she's got her physical presence, but she also has this sort of extended presence. And then the translator was just a fun thing to work with for me, because I'm a Russian speaker, and I can, you know, one of the pleasures of speaking a second language is actually modulation, right? So one of the wonderful things about, for example, being in Russia is if I sit in a cafe and I want to work, I can ignore conversations that are going on around me in Russian in a way I cannot ignore conversations going on around me in English, which is much more sort of built into my system. And so I can modulate my engagement with Russian, and I can also pretend, which I've done many times, to speak Russian, you know, less well than I do if I don't want to engage with someone, right? So in a sense, like, I do, you know, a lot of what Altan Setseg, so maybe one of the reasons I like Altan Setseg so much is she's so much like me at my sort of spikiest, right? When I'm at my most introverted moments, where I'm like, I don't want to talk to people, and so I'm going to put on my broken translator, right? And pretend not to, you know, be able to communicate. But yeah, she's able to modulate the extent to which she is engaged with the world in many different ways, but both by plugging into this larger system, and then also, you know, by modifying her ability to communicate with others in order to hide behind that the broken translator, or reveal herself to be much more than people thought she was by putting on the translator that works. And some of this was directly inspired by a James Tiptree Jr. Novella, which is called The Girl Who Was Plugged In. And, William Gibson loved this novella. And William Gibson is the last person who would say that he invented cyberpunk, right? Or something like that. He like really hates that. But I would argue that The Girl Who Was Plugged In is the original cyberpunk novella. And Altan Setseg is a commentary in some ways on The Girl Who Was Plugged In.
So I thought that was really interesting what you just said about Altan Setseg extending her senses through technology. There's a lot of surveillance that goes on in the book. There's Altan Setseg, obviously. There are the listening devices that I believe it's the man from the Republic of Istanbul talks about, and also the octopuses, we find out, are also conducting their own surveillance practices. How Why does surveillance play such a large role in the lives of these people?
I think that surveillance has become a fundamental way. It's become completely entangled with modern life, right? When you think about it, the instruments of surveillance are also the instruments of convenience for us. So when we plug into like a GPS system and we navigate our cars around or ourselves around a new space, we are employing the instruments of surveillance, right? And in fact, we're employing a military instrument of surveillance, right? Which the US government just allows the rest of the world to use, which is the global positioning system, right? And so surveillance is such an enormous part of the experience of being modern now, that I think it's inevitable that it would expand enormously, in the future. It's expanding enormously. It's expanded enormously in the last 10 years. So I think people don't realize sometimes just how recently a lot of things happened, right? Like, it seems like it was forever ago, but the like button was invented in the 2010s, right? Right? I mean, it emerged like in the last decade. That's crazy, right? And that like the like button upended our entire way of communicating with each other. Because before the like button, Facebook and other places, like, engagement was writing a message back or nothing, right? And so now it's like this completely different world. So that's a fundamental change. Another fundamental change is because what happens to me is, because I'm a Foreign Service officer, and because before being a Foreign Service officer, I was overseas for a long time, I have this time warp that happens where I come back to the United States every 2 years, and like some weird new thing has totally changed life in the US, right? So this latest time it was like QR codes. Because when I left 3 years ago, there really weren't any QR codes. They were kind of this fancy thing that like you maybe use sometimes. And now it's like QR codes are everything. Like, and then before that, there was a point at which, and it wasn't that long ago, it was like 2012 or so, when it became absolutely necessary to have a smartphone with you at all times, right? And this is like literally in the last 10 years. So 10 years ago, you could do most of what you might do in a city without a smartphone, just a flip phone, right? You didn't need to have all these apps. And now it's like unimaginable. You cannot navigate modern life without this device, right? And so for me, the cellular phone is an instrument of surveillance, right? It tells companies, it tells everyone where you are, what you want, what you're doing, what your desires are. So we've built surveillance really into our lives. And I don't think necessarily that all surveillance is bad, because on the flip side of that, right, science is surveillance, right? And the most of the developments in science have kind of come from, well, three different things: the incredible creativity of the human thought process, which I think cannot be minimized, the ability to compute larger and larger amounts of data, right, which has allowed science to really push further out into studying larger and larger areas. And then the extension of the human sensory apparatus, right? It's really the extension of the human sensory apparatus that has allowed for huge things like astronomy, right, to develop. And, with the microscope, microbiology, all of those things, a lot of this is about extending our sensory apparatus to surveil parts of the world that we never were able to look at before, right? And so for me, surveillance is A, kind of terrifying, right? Part of modern life, and gives you like the heebie-jeebies, like when you think about it too much, right? And then B, also like an extraordinarily mind-expanding thing that we use all the time and don't think about. Like these satellite views. And I mean, I use surveillance for research, right? I don't believe that personal experience is enough. So I always couple personal experience with tons of research. And so I was looking at satellite images of the Condal Archipelago the whole time I'm writing this book. I was like, the hotel where they were living is a real place, right? And I was using Google and, you know, things to like surveil that real place and, you know, line it up with the actions of the characters and all that stuff. So it is like surveillance is this fantastic way of expanding our minds outside of our own skulls and beyond the limits of our human sensory apparatus, but also absolutely horrifying and a great threat to our personal freedoms, right?
There was a line in the book that was like, technology is there's always the flip side of it. It's like there's always the unintended consequences that are going to happen. And if we come up with one form of technology, there's going to be, first of all, there's going to be the consequences, the unintended negative consequences, but then there's also going to be a new technology that has to pop up in order to deal with the old technology.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the agent from Istanbul talks a lot about, you know, he has a collection of these surveillance devices, right, that are increasingly more clever. And then also increasingly more clever are the ways in which people fight against
them. Right, yeah.
And, you know, he talks about like the thousands and thousands of human hours spent both inventing these things and trying to eliminate them. And I think that's a good sort of way of talking, you know, in general about like technology. It's like all of these amazing human inventions, and then all of these inventions invented to counter the negative effects of those human inventions. Yeah. Right. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was not, you go if it's still about this. I was going to change.
No, it's totally fine.
Okay. I wanted to talk now about the octopuses. I think part of the reason I found this book so terrific is because it's so scientifically compelling. Like I learned a lot about octopuses even as they are now. Mm-hmm. How do you understand octopus intelligence?
Well, so...
Or let me narrow the question maybe.
Sure.
How is it different from human intelligence just in the way that it's organized bodily?
Yeah. So backing up a little bit from that, there's an interesting thing that English has that almost no other language really has, and that's phrasal verbs. And I think phrasal verbs are an interesting place to start, because phrasal verbs are things like, oh, you know, I'll pick you up on the way to the theater. And then since we're going in the same direction, I can drop you off at this place, right? Well, pick up and drop off and leave behind and, you know, get over something, right? All of the what phrasal verbs are really interesting is they are all physical metaphors of how the body operates in its environment, right? And so they frustrate people trying to learn English because they replace English verbs that have counterparts in other languages, right? We would never say anything except I'll pick you up. But in fact, you know, it's like there is a verb that's replacing, right? And there's a verb that dropping someone off is, you know, replacing, right? I mean, there's verbs like deposit or, you know, collect that we don't use. We just use like these phrasal verbs. What phrasal verbs show to me is the importance of embodiment in meaning. So our meaning, and this is one of the reasons, for example, why artificial intelligence doesn't work very well, and why robots really struggle despite decades of money being poured into developing them. They're still sort of staggering around. Living things are embedded in space and time in a way that is completely fluid, in which we form a part of a loop with our environment. And all of our communications emerge out of that physical embodiment within an environment. So this was an idea that I was really taking very seriously coming into the book, which is if you're going to speak, if you're going to communicate with another animal with such a physically different way of being in the world, that communication is going to be really difficult. And so some readers have complained, for example, that there's not enough progress made in the communication with the octopus. And I would counter that I think, in fact, I was a little bit optimistic about how easy it might be to communicate with the octopus. And I was a little bit optimistic on purpose to kind of give the readers something. In fact, I think it would be nearly impossible, right? Because we have this very centralized collection of neurons all leading back to our brain. And then this spinal cord that radiates those commands kind of out to our limbs. And this is underplaying in some ways the new science that we've found that really shows how much more integrated our nervous system is with our guts and like other things. But I'm somewhat simplifying. But in general, you can say that creatures with a spine and a large brain at the end of that spine are pretty centralized systems where a lot of the activity, the neural activity is occurring inside that centralized brain behind our skulls. Octopuses are not structured like this at all. Most of their neurons are in their limbs, and they have a very strange neural structure where they have neurons that go throughout their limbs, and then they also have a circular neural sort of loop so that the limbs appear to be able to communicate, sort of think about their environment in a sense by themselves, and then also maybe communicate those thoughts to one another in a ring that goes around the limbs. And then they do have a sophisticated central brain, but because it's not the destination of some of that neural activity and it's not as sort of top down in its structure, you can sort of think about the octopus's mind as being suffused throughout its body in a way that human beings' brains are not. So the octopus is almost in a way a mind in the ocean, right? Like a brain sort of floating around with limbs that are exploring these things. And what would it be like to be that? I mean, I think that what happens quite often with an octopus, and you can see this in videos of the way that octopuses interact with their environment, is that when startled, the octopus's control system will immediately revert to that central brain and it will start doing things very quickly. But when it's not, and when it's just sort of in its regular mode, it's kind of just walking around and those limbs are thinking about touching things. They're reaching out, they're exploring, they're doing stuff. And I think it's a little bit like what it would be like. Okay, so do you drive? Okay, so people who drive, I think all of us have had the experience of waking up while driving, right? Where you're like, oh crap, I have been in charge of, you know, thousands of pounds of careening metal without being aware of it. That is really bad. I think that an octopus probably spends a good deal of its time in that state, where the central mind is sort of daydreaming while its limbs are doing other things that it's not entirely aware of. And then all of a sudden it'll be like, oh, predator, right? And kind of centralize its activity. So I think it's something like that. But there's other weird things going on. So for example, if an octopus learns something new with one eye and one side of its body, the other side of its body and the other eye won't learn that thing for a day. So there's some kind of weird hemispheric disconnection going on inside the octopus as well. So the octopus is just a great example of how science is amazing, but science is still quite limited in its reach. And there's a lot of things that we're not fully understanding going on there. But I think that, you know, the main idea is that I wanted the challenge to be convincing. You know, it's not like, oh, you know, these octopuses show up and all of a sudden we're basically, you know, composing a grammar of their symbolic communication, right? Instead, it's like misstep after miscommunication after, semi-violent negative encounter after violent encounter. So you know, there is this like sense in which the octopus is also as indifferent to human beings and their desires as we are to their desires, right?
It was just another example that was making me think a lot about the idea of selfhood. In that the octopus, it does feel like a decentralized self, or like it's hard to pinpoint where self lies in the octopus. Is it in one of the tentacles that's searching for one thing right now? Or is it in the decentralized, like, head? And that was similar kind of to the way that you created an understanding of Evrim, and that, sorry, what was the man who was mapping the consciousness name?
Oh, Rustem. Yeah.
Yeah. The way Rustem was also thinking about consciousness. Well, Evrim, first of all, in that they were, they're a conglomeration of multiple different minds into one, patched into kind of one, but also not. And the way Rustem understands consciousness as, or the self as something that's a, just a tangle of different individual neurons folded into a pattern. It was just, it feels like there was such an expansion of what self means in all of these characters or all of these beings.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in reality, that's true. So, I mean, one of the things that that I'm always aware of is, you know, the self exists in what I would call, what I like to call place-time, right? So we exist in space-time, of course. I mean, we have this, you know, sense of forward motion, and there's a way in which time is, you know, is not real, but it's also created by gravity and all these things. And we all, we understand that, I think. We're educated to understand that, at least theoretically. But we also exist in something called place-time, right? For me, which is on top of that space-time, you also have culture and the social and all of this communication going on with our environment, with one another, et cetera. And that completely restricts and enables what the self is capable of. I mean, you and I would just be completely fundamentally different people if we both existed, for example, during the late Eastern Roman Empire, right? In Constantinople. Like, we just could not possibly be who we are in that place time. We couldn't possibly be having the kinds of conversations that we do. And yet we think of ourselves as being these very concrete, right? You know, motivated, directed kind of entities. And we think about freedom in that way and ideas of free will. And I'm not saying that free will does not exist, but I'm just saying that all of these things are impinged upon by the environment. So the self is kind of constructed, not just internally, but externally. And so for me, in a way, like the octopus and Altan Tsetsek and Evrim and Ha and Rustem and all of the characters in the book, what they all have in common is this: they undermine, or they hopefully will undermine, you know, the reader's sense that the self is a contained entity, that it ends at the skin, that it ends at the skull, right? That it ends at the fingertip. I mean, the self extends throughout the internet, the world around us, the things that we can learn from other people and our upbringings. And we're just so completely embedded in context, right? Of course, in Buddhism, it's like the sense of dependent co-arising, right? Like how everything comes into being together and affects everything else. And it, I think that, you know, the difference of where we are right now in modern society is that, like, that sounded really woo-woo to most people 30 years ago. You know, most people 30 years ago was like, yeah, yeah, like everything depends on everything else, blah, blah, blah. And now everyone's like, oh yeah, everything depends on everything else, right? Like ecology, you know, what we're doing to the world, animal extinction, you know, our own interactions, racism, gender, like all of this stuff depends on the context in which it's all embedded. And I think people actually are starting to really take that into account. Like, our actions have consequences for other people, right? People don't get to just do whatever they want.
Right. But also on the flip side of that, I felt like that contextualization of the selves, of the characters, made you really sympathetic towards them. Like, there was nobody that was the villain of the story. Nobody whose actions were emanating from some evil place inside themselves. Everybody was really deeply ingrained in the system and the structures that that encapsulated them. Like, I didn't, it seemed like the only real evil in the story, it wasn't even like the corporations that were creating these profit-driven activities or like that were the reason that the people were being enslaved on the ships. It was like a structure or a kind of outlook of indifference that was the real villain in the story. Is that, do you feel like that's true?
Yeah, you got it. That's it. Indifference is the real villain in the story. And I think, you know, we as a society need to give up in some ways on our ideas of villains, right? There's no Iago, right? That was interesting hundreds of years ago, but now we've come to realize that, you know, the real things are structures that create people who do bad things, but those people are doing bad things because of the way that they've been formed by a structure, right? Generally. And so, yeah, that's exactly it. And indifference, I think, is the great poison, I think, especially in the Western system. It's the thing that poisons all of our interactions with one another, and it poisons our interaction with the world. The false idea that we can just do whatever we want and we don't have to think about the consequences of those things. I mean, I think one of the confrontations that's happening right now in society is that it used to be that people could think, and it seemed reasonable to think, if I say something, it is my intent that matters, right? I am the sort of master of what comes out of my mouth and what it means. And now they're being confronted with the fact that meaning exists only in context. And the listeners, the way the listener is affected by what's being said is not only just kind of important, but in fact, integral to the act of communication itself. And so, no, you're not the master of, you know, the things that you say, and you don't determine their meaning. Meaning is determined collectively by, you know, by society, and meanings are changing, right? And that has to be accounted for. And I think that's actually one of the frustrations that I see with, and this happens, you know, I don't want to say it's exclusive, but it happens a lot with older people who grew up in a society where they felt that meaning was created by the speaker, right? And that the person receiving the words did not get to respond to that in the same way. And I think that way of understanding meaning is dying away. But we're going through this really uncomfortable cultural moment where people are like, no, 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 I'm not racist, for example, right? And then you have people saying, no, no, like, your actions are racist, and it doesn't depend on whether you intend them to be so. It's because they're embedded within a system of racism which you are partaking in, you know, et cetera. So I think that they're important things to be considering sort of as a society as well, right? But yeah, indifference, you totally got it.
I feel like there was also, though, it wasn't that you were letting the characters off the hook completely. Like, they were also responsible for their individual indifference.
Yes, 100%. I don't believe that. I don't believe that people are not responsible. You know, I don't think that people can be, yeah, left off the hook is a good way to put it, right? And a good metaphor for a for a book that takes place in and around the ocean, too. But yeah, they really can't be, because their actions have consequences, and because we are, even if we are only apes in a way, right? We are apes with incredibly sophisticated minds that allow us to make choices. And even under duress, most of us can make better or worse choices. I say most of us because there are people who are so subject to, you know, abuses of one type or another that they're not able any longer to make good choices. And unfortunately, in our society, those people who are unable to make good choices tend to be the ones who are also subjected to the justice system the most,
Well, I'm looking at the clock, and I think that this is all the time we have.
This is wonderful.
Thank you so much.